The topic tonight is relative and absolute truth. This is an idea that developed after the Buddha's death, but before the split between Theravada and Mahayana Buddhism. So it's been around for a long time. There are both good things and bad things about the idea of two truths. And I'll touch on a few. To begin with, I prefer to think of it as conventional and absolute truth. So that's how I'll speak of it tonight. The human world is full of conventions. We're surrounded by customs, and we take a risk when we depart from conventional behavior. All language is a convention. Anthropologists and linguists say that it probably started out as emotive grunts that just totally were what the person was feeling. Very easy to understand. But language has become a much more complex thing with really pretty elegant statements that can communicate deep ideas. All of our lives are surrounded by conventions. And they create a shared world that we can work with, but which unfortunately doesn't correlate very well to what's really going on according to the Buddha's teachings. Conventions have tremendous power for us as animals. Living together with conventions, we humans have achieved a mastery over so much of this earth that we may manage to exterminate ourselves. Through our social conventions, though, we can live rather comfortably together. As lone individuals, we kind of take our chances with survival. But living in this matrix of conventions, we end up relating to the concept of things rather than to things as they truly are. Here's a simple example. We can talk about a pumpkin and understand how to carve that pumpkin into a jack-o'-lantern when there's no actual pumpkin involved. It's just a conversation. We're just dealing with an idea. Most of our time is spent this way, floating through a long series of mental constructions. And this is the way of living that many people over the millennia have called the relative or the conventional truth. Buddha's teachings give us a way to see through conventions to what is called the absolute truth by analyzing our conventional understanding of things. So let's try it with a watering can. If I ask you to hand me that watering can, you'd recognize it sitting there and pass it to me. But if you wanted to know what it truly is, then you would use Buddha's analysis for seeing its essential nature as a watering can. You'd ask, is it the spout that makes it a watering can, or the handle, or the part that holds the water? Is any of its parts, or the whole of it, permanent, impervious to change? Where is the essence of this watering can, its very itness? Eventually, you realize that this watering can is a phenomenon that has come into being and will, like all phenomena, ultimately pass away. It has no enduring self, separate from all the rest of the change that's constantly going on. It is a transitory coming together of matter and energy that we, by convention, recognize as pretty handy for watering our potted plants. So by analyzing the whole and its parts of a thing, in this way we gain an intellectual understanding of the concept of anatta, or emptiness. Now, even if you were to think, oh, I get it, there's still a notion of a me that's holding on to this concept of getting it, which is yet another convention. And it's a serious one. The concept of I, me, and mine sets up a duality between self and other, between our subjective experience and objective things or events around us. And we take all this very seriously. We take ourselves seriously. Even when we're not liking ourselves very much, what's wrong with us is our favorite topic. And we definitely take things seriously. We want them, or we really don't want them. We have feelings of desire or aversion about them, and that makes them sticky. So we get attached to almost everything. We cling to stuff and live like insects entangled by countless sticky strands to things. And because all of this stuff isn't static the way we think it is, but it's a part of an ongoing process of change, we get disappointed by it. We suffer, and we're going to keep suffering until we stop seeing things in this way that makes them so sticky. So to grasp the ultimate truth free of conventions, we need to follow Buddha's instruction to meditate. At first, we need in our meditation to calm the mind so it will withdraw from its usual preoccupation with the conventional world. And once the mind has become still and rested, then it can investigate what's true. Say, a sensation of coolness travels up the arms, and our mind says, oh, chilly breeze, I'd better put on a sweater. The still mind can notice the arising of the sensation, the recognition and conceptualization of that phenomenon. Then the aversion to being chilly and the mental activity, the thought that prompts us to change our clothes. like everything else, this phenomenon is impermanent, prone to suffering, and empty. Those are the three characteristics of all experience: anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Impermanent, suffering, and emptiness. With a breeze, it's easy to see there's nothing substantial in it. Still, something as apparently solid as a cannonball is just as empty of an enduring separate reality. It's still composed of parts that have come from all the rest of this unified process of change, become a cannonball, and then it's eventually going to become something different. We can journey into the heart of this truth through meditation by directly observing what arises in our awareness. The quiet mind is able to discern the flow of sensations and mental activity without getting entangled with convention. Over and over, it looks at what arises in its awareness and asks, "What is this? What causes and conditions gave rise to this?" Sometimes we have to narrow our observation to a small range of phenomena, like sensations. Pain is a good example. We think of pain as a thing that we have. Then, when we observe it for a while, we realize it's more fluid than that. It can be intense and then fade, or go from burning to itching and then pulsing and then completely vanish for a time. And it can move around. Finally, we have to admit that what's happening isn't an it at all. A lot of the unpleasantness of pain is the aversion that we have to the very idea of pain. So when we let go of the concept and the aversion, the experience often isn't so bad after all. Whatever we observe is the subject of our investigation. When I go into the mountains on my summer midweek self-retreats, I don't have an agenda set out. I sit when it seems appropriate, and I do a lot of walking meditation too. There are things I need to do, like set up camp and get out the stove and fix dinner. And I just watch whatever happens in my awareness as I do these things. Sometimes there's an easy concentration, and sometimes there's impatience about having to do this task, or frustration when I'm having some difficulty. Whether I'm meditating or doing a task, I just watch what arises in my awareness and ask, "What is this? Is there suffering? What are its causes and conditions?" Whatever the mind observes can yield a treasure of understanding. Whatever has the attention of the quiet mind is the lesson for that time. Once we've observed this coming and going of phenomena and understand that they arise and pass, they lose their stickiness. We can let go of them. We are liberated from the suffering that clinging to them brings. we keep doing this investigation practice, and more of our experience loses its conventional claim on us. We see its emptiness. We begin to see through the apparent reality of the conventional world to something that isn't empty and impermanent. This is the nature of pure, simple awareness, what some call Buddha mind. Others call this awareness the absolute truth. The words are completely irrelevant. The absolute is impossible for one person to describe or explain to another. The suttas use a lot of superlatives to try to convey its nature. They say stuff like ultimate ease, complete peace, or subtle and profound beyond all conventions. It stands to reason that if this awareness is beyond convention, then conventions, including language, cannot express it. We have to see it for ourselves. The reason we talk about it at all is to motivate students to look for it. There's a great deal of confusion that has grown up around this process of learning to see the ultimate, the absolute. Some people are afraid of the process of letting go. Students often ask if they're going to be able to function in their jobs or with their families if they let go too much. They think that they'll become too mellow, that a peaceful mind is like being drugged past caring. Listen, Buddha cared. He considered taking his enlightenment and going off into solitude, but instead chose to spend the rest of his life teaching out of compassion for others. Another common concern is that when we see through the conventions of self and other, or me and mine, we won't have the mental capacity to function in this world. Well, again, the example is Buddha, who was very adept at dealing with any situation that arose involving people with very high IQs or low ones. He could interact with kings and blacksmiths, farmers, and merchants. The awakened mind doesn't just live in some ghost realm of an absolute. It sees beyond conventions, but it sees them too. There is nothing to fear in enlightenment. All right, now that I've constructed this idea, I need to smash it. This idea that's been around for millennia, this notion of two truths, the conventional and the absolute, is just another convention. And as I said before, we need to go beyond thinking about it and meditate so that we can observe it in our own awareness. There are some dangerous elements in this idea of the two truths. Foremost is that this idea that there are two things which are different truths. Here's a quarter. I look at it and I see a guy wearing a wig. Okay, then I flip it over and I see an eagle with outstretched wings? Which is the real quarter? Or there's someone with two legs who walks from here to there. Which of the two legs really did the walking? So there aren't two distinct truths, either of which could stand on their own. Such a duality would be completely contrary to the non-duality that Buddha taught. The Heart Sutra, that great Mahayana teaching about emptiness, talks about conventional form and absolute emptiness. It ends by saying, form is emptiness, emptiness form. In order to see the absolute, we have to study the conventional. Turn it over. See both sides. Also, this idea of two truths also implies that one of them is higher than the other, or that one isn't really true. Usually it's the conventional truth that gets disrespected. But you know, we live here in this conventional world. Buddha lived here. Countless fully enlightened beings have walked through the marketplaces and the war zones of this world. We're just talking about a way to deal with the allure of the conventional world so that we can catch a glimpse of the awareness that isn't contained in convention. Jack Kornfield's book title says, "After the Ecstasy, the Laundry." When our practice gives us glimpses of the absolute, we want to hold on to that vision. Most people need the last days of a retreat to reintegrate their minds. It's like getting a much stronger prescription for your glasses. It takes a while to get used to this new way of seeing. But we manage. We make it back home, and we do chores. We handle problems. We go to lunch with friends. And the powerful insights that we had on retreat stay with us. Reintegrating can go on for months afterward as we gradually see how this or that epiphany plays out in our real life, our conventional life. The epiphany that I had on my last retreat was about losing sight of the absolute and taking the conventional at face value, as if it's all there is. How often we do this? These are times when I seriously lose mindfulness and can veer off into badly disturbed states of mind and unfortunate conduct. I realized on retreat that even in a conventional state of mind filled with suffering, I am not the one who suffers. I am not who I think I am. I also have an awareness that can be unrestricted, luminous, and sublime. I am this being that is both. And when I remember the absolute, I can take refuge. Next week, Deb is going to talk more about taking refuge, so I'll let her explain this wonderful resource that we all have. When I remember the Buddha mind, I can shift into this awareness that is not ruled by convention. I can't stay there for a long period of time, but at least I can access it, and I can let go of whatever the conventional mind has been clinging to. It brings instant relief from the suffering and a return to peace of mind. At the end of my retreat, I made a list of the places where I get stuck to the conventional world a lot. These places come from deeply held attitudes that are very sticky. It can be like wearing blinders and saying to ourselves, "I am not the one who sees things this way," can make the blinders fall away and reveal the bigger picture. It can bring us equanimity. Here are some of the things on my list. I am not the one who always needs to be right, who wants to be admired. I am not the one who fears discomfort, who judges others, who has done something wrong, who has lost something. I am not the one who needs control, and I am not the one who loves the one who does or is all of this. So last month, I had to figure out how to arrange the rest of my life to avoid being uncomfortable in my old age. Of course, this is an impossible task, but everyone of a certain age has to undertake it. Certain decisions have to be made, like Medicare and Social Security. I was spinning my wheels trying to ensure that I'll always be comfortable, getting more and more uptight and unpleasant. Finally, I remembered, I'm not the one who needs to be right or the one who fears discomfort. And the tension melted away. I almost couldn't believe it, how quickly that happened. Sometimes I look at other people and judgments about them just come up into my mind. And I feel bad about that. But I can let go of that guilt and remember that judgment arose from my upbringing in this conventional world. I am not the one who judges others. It is not something chosen by the mind that is quiet and clear. There are many other ways we can remind ourselves to see the truth beyond the conventional world. Wendy Palmer, an Aikido master and teacher, and the author of The Practice of Freedom, talks about a vertical rather than a horizontal orientation to life. When we stand on two legs, the length of our bodies is vertical to the planet's surface, while our heads rotate around and we look at a horizontal field of view. So we're vertical, but very often our consciousness is horizontal. In Aikido, this is key to maintaining balance, coming back again and again to that line that goes from the earth to the heaven. If we get caught in a horizontal perspective during Aikido or in life, we only see things out there that impact us in here. It makes us defensive and aggressive. But if we see over that horizontal view, remembering that we're vertical, then we can move around, keeping our balance, so that any force coming at us can be diverted and no one gets hurt. That's just such a great metaphor for the goal of not hurting anyone, any being. Both views, horizontal and vertical, conventional and absolute, are true. And it's best if we can hold them both in our minds. Whatever helps us remember how things truly are and to let go of our attachments is good. Our techniques for remembering, like my I am not the one who, may wear out over time. And we may need to learn about other tricks that people have used. There are countless recommendations in the suttas and the literature. I invite you to try them liberally and use whatever helps you live with the relative and the absolute truth.